compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. I was telling you before the break about St. Rita of Kasha. She died in, 1457. And she became a great saint. She became a religious sister. She got married in an arranged marriage when she was 12 years old. Hard to imagine, but they used to do that back in those days. So she was married to a dude named Paolo. He's described in this article online as rich, quick-tempered, and immoral. And he had many enemies. They were married for 18 years. And during their married life, she bore a few children to him, and she was known as a model wife. So here's the description. Rita endured his insults, physical abuse, and infidelities for many years. According to popular tales, through humility and kindness and patience, Rita was able to convert her husband into a better person, more specifically renouncing a family feud known at the time as La Vendetta. Rita eventually had two sons, Gian Giacomo and Antonio, and Paolo Maria, a third child, brought them up in the Christian faith. As time went by and the family feud between the two families became more intense, Paolo became congenial, but his allies betrayed him and he was violently stabbed to death. So after his death, Rita gave a public pardon at his funeral to the murderers of her husband. His brother continued the feud, and he wanted to get revenge. So he convinced Rita's sons to leave their manor at their ancestral home and to work with him to revenge the death of their father. This just descends into chaos and more murder and more sin. And so the sons eventually die. After the death of her husband and sons, Rita, she realized her desire to enter the monastery of St. Mary Magdalene in Kasha, but she was turned away. This was something she had wanted to do from the time she was a child, and she realized she still wanted to do it, even though she had been married for 18 years. The convent acknowledged Rita's good character and piety, but the nuns were afraid of being associated with her due to the scandal of her husband's violent death. However, she persisted in her cause and was given a condition before the convent would accept her, the task of reconciling her family with her husband's murderers. Can you imagine? You're the wife, you're the widow of like the Sopranos, except that you weren't doing anything wrong, but your soprano husband and soprano sons and soprano in-laws were doing all this violence and stuff. And the convent, you just want to go in and be a nun. And the convent says, okay, on one condition, you've got to get the soprano family, you know, united and on good terms. And I never saw the Sopranos. I can't go very deep into that because I don't know the names of any of the characters other than the main one, obviously. But I imagine it must have been something like that. So they said, you got to make peace with these people first. And she did that. And then they let her into the convent. Other legends about her say that she was transported into the monastery of St. Mary Magdalene by levitation. So miracles and things abounded in her life and certainly after her life. The main thing, though, is that this woman had a very difficult marriage, and she was married to a real jerk, to put it lightly. And a couple of things stand out for me. One is that she gradually reformed him by her heroic patience and by her unswerving love. I'm sure she must have been a kind of irritation to him with his wicked ways, and she was a good woman. And he did not convince her to leave her heroic virtue. And eventually that had a good effect on her. I wonder, and I half suspect, that maybe he died in the state of grace, because as the story says, toward the end of his life, he kind of grew out of all that nonsense, and maybe he had been to confession shortly before he was murdered. Maybe he's in heaven. You know, wouldn't it be interesting to meet some of these? And you will. When you get to heaven, you'll meet these people. 888-914-9149. Elijah in Virginia, thank you for holding and welcome.
Hello, Patrick.
Hi there.
So my question is kind of in terms of Sunday. So when I was younger, I was a big soccer player, and fortunately my family and I would sometimes skip mass to go to tournaments mm-hmm. for soccer. And I just recently got married. I'm trying to start a family. So for my kids, I want to make sure that they still keep Sunday holy. So my question is, what are some criteria of things that, you know, are allowed as long as you go to Mass prior? A specific example being a soccer tournament for my future kids, God willing.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Sunday obligation, wherever it obtains, and it obtains virtually everywhere now, I think we're pretty much over the COVID lifting of the obligation. So let's just assume that it's where you are, that the obligation is in force. The obligation stipulates that you must go to Mass on Sunday, or you can attend the vigil Mass the night before. But one or the other, you have to do that under pain of serious sin. Now, if you can't go due to illness or travel, let's say that you're taking a flight and it won't land in time for you to get to Mass. I mean, there are reasons why you do not have to fulfill that obligation if it's beyond your control. Illness, as I say, or maybe someone in your family is ill and you're the only person who can stay home and take care of that person. So there are extenuating circumstances, and the church understands that. But shy of those things, or without any of those things being present, then there is the obligation to go to Mass. Now, if you can go to Mass on Saturday night at the vigil Mass, and then you would be free to attend the soccer tournament and not have to worry about your Sunday obligation because you have fulfilled it. Or maybe you can go to a very early Mass and fulfill your obligation before the tournament starts. I know that's not always possible. But by all means, I would not put soccer ahead of your relationship with God and the obligation that we have as Catholics to go to Mass on Sunday. And furthermore, I would also strongly encourage you to not do that for the sake of your children, because if they grow up thinking, well, Mass is just optional, you can just do that whenever, soccer is the most important thing, then that, of course, will ruin effectively, I think, their ability to function as Catholics in this difficult world. So for their sake as well, I would strongly encourage that.
Awesome. I completely agree. I would rather, you know, they'd be mad at me and go to Mass and miss games than, you know, hinder the relationship with God. Thank God for my wife. You know, she helped me back to the faith. But anyway, I don't want to take up too much of your time. I thought that would just be helpful for other people who are starting to start families, and this applies to them. Thank you so much, Patrick.
You're most welcome. Thank you. And I hope your kids are successful in soccer, and even more successful in their practice of the Catholic faith. Thank you. That reminds me, Elijah's call reminds me of the story of the mother and her seven sons in the Book of Maccabees. It's really a difficult story to read, but it is, I'll condense it for you. So here's what happened. The king who had taken over that part of the land of Israel had ordered the Israelites to eat pork, and she and her sons said no. And so one by one, the king had each son brought and tortured. This is in 2 Maccabees, okay? So he had each of the sons tortured in front of the other ones. And one of them, you know, gets fried in a big frying pan. They have their tongues cut out. They have their skin removed. They have, you know, body parts cut off, etc. It's just a terrible story. But in each case, the mother is there with her seven sons. And as the son kills each one, is one of the sons, they heroically stand up and say, we're not going to do it. This is against God's law. God says we're not allowed to eat pork, so you can do whatever you want to us, but we're not going to violate God's law. And each one dies, and then the mother dies. But it's an example of this. Does she die in the end? I think she dies in the end. At the very least, all seven, I have to go back and reread it, but all seven of the sons die. And that was over not eating pork. So for me, the takeaway is that, yeah, that's a minor thing, okay? But they would not violate God's law. God said, don't eat pork. Okay, God said it. I don't have a choice in this matter. Is there anything intrinsically wrong with pork? No. But it was ritually unclean for the Israelites. There were a few other animals that were considered ritually unclean, and they just wouldn't eat it. And so to be willing to, not just to be willing to die, but to be willing to die such a horrifying death because you won't eat a piece of bacon, I mean, that requires a level of fidelity to God's commands that is just mind-blowing, if you ask me. So I've thought about that story in 2 Maccabees many times over the years when I think, you know, well, you know, I can, I'm tempted at times, like you are, to cut corners. You know, maybe your temptation is, well, I know I'm supposed to fast for 1 hour before Holy Communion, but I want a cup of coffee. And, you know, you have that cup of coffee or you, you know, eat some food. It's a little thing, right? It's a little thing. I mean, there's nothing intrinsically evil about drinking a cup of coffee. The evil, the wrong, is in doing it because you know that you're violating a custom or a discipline of the church. And you may say, yeah, but that's just a man-made rule. That's true. But Jesus gave those men that he established as the apostles the authority to make those rules. In fact, he said in Luke 10:16, he who listens to you listens to me. He who rejects you rejects me. And that, of course, is not only applicable to the original apostles, but by extension to their successors. So when you feel tempted to cut a corner, or, you know, it's just Mass on Sunday, I'll go later in the week. How about that? Like you're bargaining with God. Don't do that. And I know it's easier said than done at times, but don't do that. Don't give in to that, because as Jesus himself said, if you are faithful in little things, you will be faithful in big things. If you are unfaithful in little things, you'll be unfaithful in big things. And I think it's about as big as it gets when the king's, you know, brings you before him and says, eat this piece of bacon. I know that it's forbidden to you as Jews to eat this, but I want you to eat it. And then I'll let you go. You can go have a great life. In fact, I'll make your life even easier. I'll do all kinds of nice things for you. All I want you to do is eat this bacon. Come on. Well, it's a little thing, but it's also a big thing. And if those young men who died as martyrs that day, if they had given in on a regular basis, yeah, I'll just have a little bacon here or there, no big deal. You know, when you get to that big situation where your life is on the line and you're either going to go along with what is being asked of you or not, you're definitely going to cave. You're definitely going to cave. I guess the mother did die. Yeah. I need to go back and reread that story. I've read it enough times that I should know that detail. But yeah, I believe she did die in the end. But maybe if you're wavering sometime, pull out your Bible and read 2 Maccabees and read the whole story. I think it's chapter 7. It's chapter 7 or chapter 8. 888-914-9149. How about Bob in Wisconsin? Thanks for calling in, Bob.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was excited yesterday about listening to one of your interviews, and it was about a couple. It seemed to me as though they were in midlife and could have been a second marriage or something. But
when you say interview, Bob, I mean, I don't have interviews on the program. Do you mean somebody who called in?
Somebody that called in, I'm sorry.
Okay, got it.
Anyhow, the questions that were presented were about the church's teaching on their behavior in this time of their life,
mm-hmm.
in regard to not only the marital act, but everything else that surrounds it. And everything was very interesting for me, except I was wishing or hoping that I could hear something about what happens to people like myself when we're older.
Mm-hmm.
And in our case, my friend and I, which turns out to be my cousin, we are both mid and upper 70s.
Okay. And is your friend male or female?
Your cousin? Female. Okay. Yes, we're cousins.
Okay, so
both born and raised Catholic and continue to practice our religion.
Well, that's great. That's very good. So let me understand the circumstances then. So your friends, your cousins, is this a romantic friendship or a platonic friendship, or how would you describe it?
It has kind of developed into more romantic than, of course, we necessarily expected, but it's because we've both been widowed. I have been widowed twice, And it's all about loneliness and seeing a potential here for something for the rest of our lives.
Right. Well, one thing to keep in mind is that friendship is a good thing, but friendships can be turned into bad things if they are taken in a direction that's not appropriate. So I'm sure you already know that in terms of marriage, because you have consanguinity with her, you share the same familial blood, that you couldn't get married. That would be an impediment to marriage. Now, I suppose there could be a dispensation granted, but you have to petition the bishop for that. And it's possible that a bishop might grant such a dispensation to you. But if you, I mean, if this is something where you really are convinced that you want to proceed in this direction with her, and assuming that you're both free to marry, you can't marry each other under the current circumstances, but I think a bishop, at least in theory, could grant a dispensation. So that would be one thing to check into. But the church's law forbids marriage between cousins. Now, short of that, Bob, what would prevent you from having a deep friendship with her that does not become romantic slash, I mean, you would not want it to become erotic, obviously, but could you have a deep, loving friendship with her that did not involve the typical marks of affection that married couples engage in? And I'm not talking about sexual intercourse, but I mean, could you have a relationship with her that's a true deep friendship but doesn't involve romance? Is that a possibility?
At the present time, I don't see that. I see the romantic part of it being there on the table.
Okay. Well, then
and
you would...
That's probably ahead, part of my question. At what part of our lives is that ridiculous and we shouldn't even be considering something like that or what?
Well,
we have good feelings for each other. We've known each other all our lives, actually.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I'm not trying to frown on your love for her, and there's nothing wrong with loving her, but it's how you act on that love that would be the deciding factor. So if you wanted to seriously consider marriage, a couple of things. One would be pursue this with your bishop and see if he would be willing to consider a dispensation. Now, I know that the church's law forbids it, but I think that this is a law that can be dispensed by the bishop. So that would be my advice, would be to start there. And in the meantime, my other advice would be, just as it would be for anyone else who's considering marriage, don't go beyond the boundaries of what's permissible. So even though the two of you may be free to get married, and the other issue about being cousins notwithstanding, let's just assume that that wasn't an issue. Even though you're both free to get married, you're not free to engage in signs of affection that are appropriate only to married people. So you'd have to be careful, you'd have to be chaste, you'd have to be pure of heart, and the time that you spend together, make sure that it doesn't devolve into, you know, let nature take its course, which is usually what happens when two people who love each other are left alone together. One thing leads to another more often than not. So just be careful about those things so that you don't wind up falling into sin, and see what the bishop says.
Great. I knew I could count on you, Patrick. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. And last little footnote I'll mention, I have to take a break, but let's assume the worst case scenario for a minute. Let's assume that the bishop says, no, I can't do that. I'm sorry, I can't grant you a dispensation. Well, it doesn't mean you can't still love her and you can't still enjoy a deep, lasting friendship with her, but you would have to keep it chaste. You'd have to keep it non-romantic. I mean, does that mean you couldn't hold hands? No, I don't think it means that. I think you could hold hands. But you know how it is. The more intense a love you feel for somebody and the more opportunities you have, especially if you're alone, the more likely it is that you will slip into things that are not virtuous, then you'll slip into sin. So that would be my advice if the answer is no. I'm not saying that I would advise you to walk away from her or anything like that. You can maintain that friendship, but just have some fences there so that you don't wind up falling into serious sin.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much, Patrick.
You're welcome, Bob. I wish you all happiness. I really do. And I hope that this beautiful friendship that you have stays pure and beautiful and pleasing in God's eyes. Thank you, Bob. I'll be right back with more right after this.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
In keeping with that very unusual and interesting phone call that we had a moment ago, I thought I'd go to an email. It's not directly related, but it's something similar. This is from Sam in Athens, Georgia. Automatic for the people, Sam. So Sam's question is, if a good marriage includes reproduction, then is it okay for older adults to get married knowing they cannot have children? The short answer is yes, it's certainly okay. But this, I think, requires a little bit more detail for people to understand it. I have met people before for whom this is a puzzle for them, where they will say, well, if marriage is ordered toward procreation, and a marriage that, let's say, you know, when a marriage is consummated, when you get married, let's just say two Catholics get married in the church, so it's a valid marriage, it's also sacramental, and it's ratified at the wedding, so it is a valid marriage in itself because it's ratified, where the two, the man and the woman, exchange consent, and they publicly exchange consent, handing themselves over to each other until death do us part. That's when the marriage sacrament is ratified. Then it's consummated. And the question has come up, you know, what about a situation where, you know, there is, because of old age perhaps, or some other reason, that the marriage cannot be consummated. The church does have laws pertaining to that, and I won't get into them, but the fact is, more specifically, what about when the couple realizes they're both well past childbearing years, and so there is no possibility, short of a miracle, for them to conceive a child? Is it still permissible for them to get married and enjoy the goods of marriage, including the marriage act? Is that permissible to them? And the answer is a resounding yes. And the reason is that within marriage, even in the case of old age, there is nothing there. Old age, let's put it that way, would not be an impediment. There is no barrier to the couple lawfully enjoying the goods of marriage, including this one, knowing that it's essentially impossible for them to have any children. As long as they're not doing anything in that context that would prevent the possibility of having children, they are free to enjoy all the benefits of marriage, just like any couple. Any lawfully married couple, they have the same right to those things. It's part of marriage. It's the church calls it one of the goods of marriage. And these goods are held in common. They're exchanged freely in a lifelong, stable, faithful way between the husband and the wife. And so they have a right to that. And that's part of their marriage covenant, the contract. So yes, Sam, I hope that that clarifies it for you. And this, of course, assumes that this is a marriage, like you said, a good marriage. So I presume from your saying that, that you're talking about people who are lawfully wedded and they're, you know, they're able to get married, etc. I hope that helps. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Marlene in Lexington, Kentucky. Good morning, Marlene.
Good morning, Patrick. I have what I hope is a quick question. I received an annulment without my knowledge, and I'm wondering if it's because it was like the short form annulment, because my husband and I, my ex-husband and I, were both baptized Catholic but got married outside of the church. Mm-hmm. But then years later, when I came back to my faith and wanted to marry again, that's when I submitted whatever you submit, you know, to get an annulment. Mm-hmm. I was told I already had an annulment. So is that usual? It just always sort of bothered me.
I don't know if it's usual. I don't think it is, but I'm not in that world of, you know, the marriage tribunal world. So I don't really know how common that is. My understanding is that when these petitions are initiated and it starts working its way through the tribunal system, that the questionnaires that are sent out would go to both spouses. They would go to parties, parents, brothers and sisters, friends, people who would have known them at the time of the marriage, who could shed some light on what might have been going on. So my guess is that it's probably pretty uncommon for the other spouse not to know, but how infrequent it is, I don't really know. I could only guess at that.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
Did you ever, I guess I know the answer to your question, but it seems odd. You never received a questionnaire? You were never consulted if your ex-husband had initiated this process?
Right. And, you know, I was easily found, so that wouldn't have been the issue. In fact, I think my ex-husband and I had even spoken. I mean, I didn't know he's getting married. It was maybe some business thing that we were discussing that year. So, I mean, I've always thought, you know, I would like to call and ask that question. I don't really want to put anybody on the defensive, but, since you don't know, maybe I will call. Since it's been
Call the marriage tribunal. If you go to the diocesan website, there should be a number or at least an email where you can get in touch with them. And then did this take place in your diocese?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, maybe. Wait a minute. I guess I'm not sure where the line is for our diocese, so I would, but I can check that out.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, that's what I would recommend, and maybe they can give you some answers.
Okay. All right. Good.
All right. Thank you, Marlene. Nice to talk to you. 888-914-9149. We're going to get to some more fun. Yeah, I think we can get to... Actually, no, we won't be able to get to that phone call just quite yet, but I have a few other things I want to share with you. We have some more phone calls holding. I want to send a shout out to one of my buddies who sent me this information this morning, and I'm glad to be able to share it with you because it's something that will affect you as it's affecting me. I told you that, you know, things like getting chlorine for your pool, it's nigh unto impossible to get that in some parts of the country. Like where I live in Ohio, it's impossible. You can't buy... the pellet form, you know, the tablet form of chlorine. It's just unavailable. And you may remember back in the bad old days of COVID 2020 when you go into your grocery store and huge aisles would be completely empty where the toilet paper and the, you know, the Lysol and things used to be. You just couldn't get it. And now other things are coming in short supply. So it's interesting. Fox Business has got an article entitled Why You Can't Find Everything You Want at Grocery Stores. So here it goes. Grocery store chains are still battling supply challenges that some executives say are as bad as what they saw last year in spring of 2020 when hoarding left holes in stocks of some staples. Industry executives say new problems are arising weekly, driven by labor shortages and shortages of raw materials. Groceries, including frozen waffles and beverages, remain scarce as some food companies anticipate disruptions lasting well into next year. A wider range of products is running short, and logistical challenges are compounding for many retailers. Donnie Roos, chief executive of Louisiana-based Roos's Market, said he is struggling to fill shelves as his company runs low on everything from pet food to canned goods. The chain of more than 60 supermarkets is sometimes receiving as little as 40% of what it orders, prompting Roos and his staff to try to secure products earlier and more often. Before the pandemic, they received well over 90% of whatever they ordered. He says it is difficult for customers to get everything they want to get. Many grocery chains say that it's hard to predict how complete or on time their deliveries will be due to limited guidance from suppliers. I've gotten to the point where I'm hating that word now, guidance. Everything is guidance now. I'm sick of that word, guidance. But I don't know a better word for it. Advice? To keep stores stocked, retailers are rethinking when and how to procure products they sell. Some are carrying fewer flavors or sizes, selling different brands, et cetera, et cetera. Albertsons, another big grocer, said they're also feeling the impact of labor and commodity challenges, but that their supply picture has improved since last year. After stores ran short of toilet paper and canned soup in the early days of the pandemic, food manufacturers are now confronting new problems. Resin, aluminum, and other raw materials used for packaging are running short, and many producers are giving priority to their most popular items, retailers said. Industry executives and manufacturers are unable to produce enough items to meet demand, with many employees staying home because of the coronavirus or because they have received rounds of stimulus checks. That's another big problem. People can make more money sitting at home playing Xbox than they can by working their jobs because they're getting the stimulus checks. I'm not against the stimulus checks. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that, you know, some of your tax dollars shouldn't come back to you. I believe that that's a good thing in general. But one of the unintended side effects is you've got people who could and should be out there working who just are saying it's not worth it. I can make more money sitting at home playing Xbox. And so they are. Kraft Heinz's company's Lunchables have been tough to get. Canned tomato goods are running low. And it just, the list goes on. And it, if you've wondered if the stuff that you usually could buy or you could buy a lot of variety of, and you don't understand why you can't do it now, well, this is a rather lengthy article and it will give you a lot more detail on what's going on and why. But you know what the thing is? It doesn't give, I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel on this because it's not saying what's going to get better to make this problem go away. So I don't know how long this will last. We'll see. You know, people need chlorine for their pools. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Bernice in Washington. In Washington State, I think it is, or is it in Washington, D.C., Bernice?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Well, yes. Welcome.
Thank you. I wanted to let you know you were asking, the lady was asking about annulments, short-form annulments. My fiancé just received a short-form annulment, and all they require on the short form is the marriage certificate and your declaration of divorce from the state, and they just need to know that you were not married by, he was Catholic, he got married by the justice, and it was because she was pregnant, whatever, that doesn't matter as far as that goes, but they didn't contact her. All they do, they don't even ask, well, they do ask for her name and stuff, but they just ask, they just look to see if it was an invalid marriage by canonical form.
Okay.
So, in other words, he was married. He was a Catholic, married outside of the church, and not by a priest, or didn't have a witness of a priest or anybody who was, you know, in relationship to the Catholic Church. And it was granted in, I would say, it was less than 60 days. It was probably like 45 days.
Interesting. Yeah, these are matters for the canon lawyers to, I don't have a canon law background, so I can't really speak to that other than some basic things.
Right.
But I do recommend a book that will help for people who do have questions about that. It's called Annulments in the Catholic Church, Straight Answers to Tough Questions. It's written by a canon lawyer named Ed Peters, and I have found it very helpful.
Now,
so
I received my annulment from, and you had another caller. I got married completely in the Catholic Church. Both he and I were Catholic. I wanted to get married. I thought he wanted to get married. And there were things before the marriage that happened that I had no idea of. And I didn't find out when I got my divorce. I found out that he had gone to his parents and told them he did not want to get married. And they said, you can't do this to this girl. She's a lovely Catholic girl. You need to get married.
Mm-hmm.
So that was considered a forced marriage. And our marriage struggled from the very beginning. And I had no idea. I just thought, well, this is it. This is life.
Mm-hmm.
I had no clue and didn't want to get an annulment. And I had a very good friend of mine saying, you don't know what's going to happen in your future. At least try to get the annulment. And I thought I couldn't because we, you know, I went into it with my eyes wide open, but I didn't know that.
Right.
And so,
yeah, that's a classic impediment.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there were other things that happened other than that, but that was the main reason. So I got my annulment 24 years ago and my fiance, and I never thought I would get married. And I met a man who was godly and good and wonderful, and I'm so glad that I did it back then, because it was an 18-month process for the annulment back mm-hmm. then. And mm-hmm. his was due to canonical form, so it was a very easy and quick process. Now, there are impediments to doing it as the canonical form. It has to be that both parties did not want to engage in a Catholic marriage at that time.
Right. No, I'm very clear on that, Bernice. It's if the parties, one or the other, or both, I guess, go into the marriage with one of those impediments, then there is no validity. It's null from the beginning. Well, thanks for calling, Bernice. Great to talk to you. I'll be right back with more on a Taco Tuesday. Please stay right there.
It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, we're back. This is Taco Tuesday, hence the music. If you've wondered, why do they play that music on Tuesdays? That's the reason why. Interesting detail here from the Jerusalem Post. If you had to guess who is perhaps the fastest growing subset of people in New York and New Jersey, who would you think it is? Well, the answer they give is Orthodox Jews. Hasidic Williamsburg is the fastest growing assembly district in New York State. When the federal government moved up the deadline to complete the 2020 U.S. Census to the middle of the high holidays last year, many Orthodox Jews feared that the local community would not be fully counted. Rabbi Avi Greenstein said, "It's something that's very concerning to us as a community. If Orthodox Jews were undercounted in the census, it doesn't show in the data. The data, the first set of which was released last week, that release shows that Hasidic Williamsburg was the fastest growing assembly district in New York State, while in New Jersey, increasingly Haredi Lakewood grew at the highest rate of any city in the state." I know Lakewood very well. I've been to that town before, and it is just as they say, it is largely populated by Hasidic Jews, or Haredi Jews, I should say. Lakewood is now the fifth largest city in New Jersey. If its rate of growth continues, 46% in just 10 years, it could be the third biggest by the next census in 2030. The census data does not identify people as Jewish because the survey on which it is based does not ask questions about religion, but some communities are so heavily Orthodox that changes in their demographics can only be driven by Orthodox population growth. And you know why this is happening? Because they're having children, because they're heeding God's commandment to be fruitful and multiply. And they're not practicing contraception. They're not aborting their children. They're having children. So the high birth rate drives the population growth in Orthodox communities. Lakewood's birth rate is among the highest in the world. This is Lakewood, New Jersey. Lakewood is a destination for Orthodox Jews from New York City seeking a lower cost of living. The Jersey Shore city in the central to southern part of the state is also home to multiple massive yeshivas that attract young men from around the world. In New York, another dramatic population swing also stems from a change in the local Orthodox population. The population of Monroe in upstate Orange County dropped by 46%, but only because about half its residents, mostly Orthodox Jews, are now part of the newly created town of Palm Tree. Fascinating. And, you know, isn't it interesting when you look around and you see who's having children? You know, when you see that, you see places that are flourishing. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Carol in Minnesota. Hi, Carol. Welcome.
Good morning, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling
You're
to
welcome.
Find out. My husband is a convert to the faith about 25 years ago or so, and he misses Mass quite often during hunting season and things like that, and I've talked to him about the grave sin that it is to miss Mass, and mm-hmm. I don't know how much more what my obligation is to let him know and remind him, but mm-hmm. he keeps receiving when he does go, so mm-hmm. that's my question.
Have you shared what St. Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 with him, where St. Paul says not to receive communion if you're in the state of unworthiness or if you don't discern the body, don't recognize the body? He talks about in the first case, if you receive Holy Communion unworthily, then you are guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. That's a euphemism for murder. And he says, if you do this without discerning the body and blood of the Lord or believing in it, then you eat and drink damnation on yourself. Has he read those words? Because that's a warning that's directed to everybody.
No, and you said that was what verse?
Yeah, it's 1 Corinthians chapter 11. So if you want to get the full context, start reading in verse 23, where St. Paul talks about the Last Supper and what the Lord revealed to him. Then when you get to verse 28, really 27, that's where he says, whoever eats or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of profaning the body and the blood of the Lord. That's just one Bible version of it. There are different ways of saying it. And then he says, let a man... Well, I'll just mention the two. He says, then let a man examine himself and so eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment or damnation on himself. And then he goes on to say something very enigmatic. He says, that is why many of you are weak and ill and some have died. So apparently in the early church, this might have been a kind of anti-miracle in a way where people were actually maybe physically dying because they were receiving Holy Communion unworthily. That's a possibility. But wow, I mean, can you imagine?
No. And so on my part, how much, you know, besides leaning him towards that verse, you know, what other obligation do I have so that he really can, I don't know if he really understands how bad this is.
Well, I mean, hopefully that passage will help him to understand that. Mm-hmm. Is he devout in any sense, or is he just sort of going through the motions as a Catholic?
I believe going through the motions.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much, yeah.
Would he be willing to read a book, do you think?
Yeah, he might, yeah.
Okay. Well, St. Peter Julian Emyard, he has got, and I don't have it in front of me, so I can't remember the exact title. I can look it up at the next break and tell you. But he wrote very beautifully on the Holy Eucharist. And he has a book that's very, very edifying about the Eucharist. That would be one. There's a book that's not directly on the Eucharist itself, but it's called My Daily Bread. And it's a little kind of a daily reader. You can read a few pages each day. Each day is kind of a lesson. And it talks about that, among many other things. And maybe in a roundabout way, if he started to come back to a more serious practice of his faith, then he would realize, you know, I need to go to confession. If it's been a long time since he's been to confession, you know, that will begin to impress itself upon him.
Yes. Okay. That's very, very helpful. I think I've done what I can, you know, to tell him.
You can only do. Yeah, you can only do what you can do. And
right.
Obviously, you want to look out for him, but you don't want to nag him, you know, nor should
that's
he nag
exactly
you.
That's exactly it. Right, exactly. And I just didn't know how far, and is, you know, once enough, twice enough, in God's eyes to,
yeah,
for me,
I think,
you know.
I think you've done everything you can. I mean, only you would know for sure, but I think that if you were showing him a good example by your own fidelity to going to confession when you need to and going to Mass prayerfully, you know, you would be showing him by example.
Okay. Yeah. All right. That's very helpful.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. I appreciate the call very much. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, we can do what we can do, but beyond that, I mean, at some point, there's a sort of diminishing returns. Who is this now? This is Judy Adler. Came up with a comment on Twitter. She says, Patrick Madrid Show, highlighting the story of a woman, saint or not, who endured physical abuse at the hands of her husband is not helpful. The last thing we should do is make women feel like they are not good enough Christians if they take care of themselves and leave. All right, Judy. I'm surprised that you're having this reaction to this. First of all, St. Reed of Kasha, that's her story. Whether you like it or not, that's her story. And you have no right to say that talking about this saint who practiced heroic virtue in the middle of a very difficult situation is not helpful. Your comment is surprising to me, because I would think that people in any situation where they find themselves in difficulties, and that's an extreme difficulty, that they should pursue virtue. And that may mean that you have to get out of that situation. In fact, that's advice that I often give when the question comes up. If there's violence in the household or something, you're not obligated to stay there. But your comment is a non sequitur. Just because that's what she chose to do, and she was able to make things work, not to mention the fact that in the 14th, 15th century, she didn't have the means to be able to say, okay, I'm going to go rent an apartment, I'm just going to go leave and do whatever I want. She didn't have that ability. So in her very difficult circumstances, she had to do the best she could. And it's unfortunate that you see that as a bad thing. So thumbs down on that one, I'm afraid. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Cecilia now in Texas. Good morning, Cecilia.
Good morning. Actually, I have an update for you. I spoke to you probably about a year ago, like around the beginning of COVID. And I had told you that my ex-husband had bought my children rosaries, and he was going to mass and things like that. Mm-hmm. And you had asked me if I would ask him on a date. Unfortunately, I never asked him on a date because I kind of had to watch and wait to see if the change was going to be permanent or temporary.
Okay.
And unfortunately, due to COVID and the church is closing down, he fell away, kind of fell back into his bad habits. So I never did that.
Okay. Fair enough.
But my question is, I'm listening to you about the Marriage Act and things like that. When I was 21, I was not close to the church at all. Mm-hmm. I tied my tubes, and when I was 35, I found out that I had uterine fibroids, which was my uterus is like a bag of marbles.
Yeah.
And now that I'm closer to the church, I'm considering, you know, if it's God's will financially and everything falls into place, of untying my tubes just for the sake of restoring my body and undoing the damage that I did. Mm-hmm. If I were to get involved, be married, and I were to consummate the marriage, knowing that I have, you know, my uterus is not healthy, and we do conceive a child in the possibility of miscarriage, is that a sin?
No. Well, let's parse this out a little bit. So if let's just assume, like you said, that you have a successful reversal of the tubal ligation, and those are routinely done mm-hmm. nowadays. So that's really good that you're considering doing that. And if you can do it, I would encourage you to do so. So let's say that works and they're restored and operative. And if you got married and I'm assuming here also that your first marriage, you would have received by that point a declaration of nullity so that you weren't just jumping into another marriage, right? So these are all assumptions on my part. So if that...
Well, my first marriage, I'm sorry, I didn't mean mm-hmm. to interrupt. My first marriage was never in the church. It was just done judicially.
Oh, I see.
So,
I
yeah.
see. Okay. So if, let's assume then that you have a valid sacramental marriage with a fellow Catholic. So... knowing that you have these internal problems that could affect fertility, I don't know, you know, the medicine behind it, so I don't know whether or not it would pose a risk to a child if you conceive. That's something you'd have to find out from a doctor. But if, just in the abstract, knowing that you have these internal problems would not be sinful for you to engage in the marriage act with your lawfully wedded husband. So you would not be doing anything wrong in that regard. If you were told by the doctor, an unborn, you know, a baby that you conceive may not be able to survive as a result of these problems, then you would have a question of saying, well, can we use natural family planning? and find out, you know, based upon observation methods, when is the fertile time of the month, and then just avoid that time, that too would be licit. So you'd be permitted to enjoy that good of marriage, but you would also be, for a time at least, you would be trying to avoid conception so as not to put that unborn child at risk. That also would be a moral way that you could go about it, because you have a right to that in marriage. And sometimes if there's a sufficient reason to avoid the possibility of conception by using natural family planning, that can be done. And so this is something you'd need to check with your doctor to see. And hopefully this problem can be corrected so that you never have to worry about it again.
Yes, sir. She actually has told me that if in the future, if something, you know, if I'm blessed with a sacramental marriage, that and I do conceive, then the fibroids would actually take away from the child, and that's what was, like, it could cause deformity and miscarriages. Okay. And things like that. And that's, yeah, why I was wondering. I know that there's another process.
I'm out of time, Cecilia. Forgive me. I'm out of time. Well, we'll leave it at that for now, and call me back another time, perhaps. I have another point I want to make to you, but I'll do that on the other side of this quick timeout. Thank you.